This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A new series about tribal cultures begins this evening on public television. The series, Millennium, is about what the modern world can learn from tribal peoples. My guest is the host of the series, David Mayberry Lewis. He's a professor of anthropology at Harvard, who for many years has studied the native peoples of North and South America. What he saw happening led him to become a human rights advocate as well as a scholar. In 1972, he and his wife founded Cultural Survival, an organization that defends the rights of indigenous societies around the world as their lands and their ways of life are threatened by development. David Mayberry Lewis wants to help tribal societies control their own destinies in the face of development, but his goal is not cultural preservation.
What we mean by cultural survival, the concept and the idea, as opposed to cultural survival, our organization, is simply an effort to allow people to make the decisions that relate to their own future. So that if a tribal society wants to preserve some kind of a core of its own culture, then we feel that it's up to us to try and help them to do that. And it is absolutely not about preserving some sort of culture trait. People so often come and say to me, these indigenous peoples, they're not really Indians, are they? They don't go around hunting with bows and arrows anymore. To which one has to reply, well, we don't ride around on horseback on the range anymore. Does that mean to say we're not really Americans? Obviously not. All societies change. Our own society has changed. When the founding fathers were writing the Constitution, they didn't imagine this enormous country where the majority of people live in the suburbs. But we're no less American for all that. And tribal peoples can make similar adjustments and hang on to their cultural core. And that's what cultural survival is all about.
I think there is this interest in saving tribal cultures as they are. Because it's an interesting mirror for other people to look at. Do you know what I mean? To kind of see a really, really, really earlier version of themselves, and to have something to measure ourselves against. We look at tribal cultures as being kind of pure, untouched by modern civilization, untouched by technology, and so on and so on and so on. And that if they lose that, then we lose a part of ourselves.
Well, of course, they're not totally pure, but they are different. And they, too, are changing. They're not static. And they're not, and it's very important to remember this, they're not sort of earlier versions of ourselves. Because the other side of thinking that tribal societies have sort of retained some sort of pristine innocence is the other opinion that you hear much more frequently, and that is that tribal societies are societies that in some sense have flunked out. They haven't made it on the evolutionary ladder, and therefore they're backward. And therefore, you know, if terrible things happen to them, that may be sad, but it's kind of inevitable. And that's untrue, too. Because, in fact, these are societies which have taken the roads that we did not. They're societies which have made and continue to make different choices. If they had all of our technology, they would still organize their lives differently.
For one of the shows, you wanted to film the Mashco Piro of Peru, and they're a hidden tribe. They, with the exception of a couple of people, they've really never emerged from the jungle, and they've never been visible to outsiders. Why did you want to include them in the series?
Well, for a number of reasons. In the first place, I'm not sure they haven't ever emerged. I suspect that the Mashco Piro probably had disastrous contacts with the rubber gatherers in Peru at the beginning of this century. In the Peruvian Amazon, those people were real sadists, and they went out and they would hold the families of indigenous people, indigenous men, hostage while they sent the men out into the jungles to gather rubber. And then as the men came in, they would be whipped to death at the whim of the overseer if they thought that if they hadn't gathered enough rubber or so on. And all of this was done in what can only be described as a concentration camp system. It was a chamber of horrors. And that all happened in the first decade of this century. Now, I suspect that the Mashco Piro were probably suffered. They were probably involved in that, and they probably suffered at that time. And that is why they have penetrated into the jungle and now don't want to come out. The mystery is the three women. These are Mashco Piro women. We know that because of the accounts of the neighboring peoples, the neighboring indigenous peoples, like the Machigenga. And these three Mashco Piro women have been wandering along the banks of this river for quite a long time. They've been seen repeatedly in the past 8 years, and yet they don't either go back and disappear into the jungle, nor are they joined by other people from their own society. So what are they doing there? And we wondered if the Mashkopiro were beginning gingerly to wonder about coming out and joining the rest of us in this world. And if so, we were very worried about what would happen to them when they did. Because normally, when very isolated peoples come out like that, they're immediately afflicted by all sorts of diseases which we have developed immunity to, and they don't have that immunity. So that the important thing is to have some sort of medical system in place in these very remote areas that could inoculate them and give them a chance of physical survival.
So you were hoping to find these three women
Indeed. And
film them and, if possible, communicate with them.
Well, it wasn't so much that we wanted to go up there and communicate with the women. We wanted to go up there and find out about the Mashkopiro.
Mm-hmm.
And we wanted to help the Peruvian authorities get a medical system in place to help the Mashkopiro if and when they emerged.
You're pretty confident that at some point they will want to emerge?
I'm sure that they'll have no choice about it.
Mm-hmm. Because the jungle is disappearing?
Exactly, and because, you know, over time people will move in, and over time they will get curious, and eventually there will be a contact.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole point was very much a cultural survival point. I'm now talking about cultural survival, the organization. The point was to have some sort of a system in place to help these people to make that transition. Then, of course, there came the whole drama of should we film them, shouldn't we film them? After all, many people have taken pictures of the Mashkopiro women, and we felt if we saw them, this would be interesting to the outside world, we should take pictures of them too. But then we ran into trouble with our indigenous friends in the Peruvian indigenous organizations, because although the local organization had no problem with this, their representatives came down from the Lima organization that said, well, wait a minute, you're letting a film crew go into these remote regions and you're going to allow them to photograph the Mashkopiro women? That's an unwise thing to do, because you can't trust filmmakers. And the other said, well, why not? I mean, we've worked with these people in cultural survival. We know they're trustworthy. Whereupon the representative from Lima said, ah, yes, but you don't have our experience. We worked with Herzog. We've been extras in his movies, and we know that filmmakers will promise you anything when they're actually in the field, and then they go back to the cutting room, and they'll cut the film in ways which you can't imagine, and they'll make you out to be savages. They'll do what they like. You don't have any control.
Well, the German filmmaker Werner Herzog, to who you refer, made
That's
two
right.
films in Latin America, Aguirre, The Wrath of God, and Fitzcarraldo.
Yes.
What exactly did he do? How exactly did he use indigenous peoples there that earned him such an unfavorable reputation?
Well, I can't really say too much about that because I don't know what he did. All I can tell you about is the reaction from our indigenous friends in Lima,
mm-hmm.
who said that on the basis, they claimed, of their experience with Herzog, but that may or may not have been the real reason for their saying this. They said, you can't trust filmmakers because they'll promise you one thing when they're in the field, and then they'll go back and do another thing in the cutting room, and you have no control over what they do. So then we had a sort of an impasse. We said, well, we really are trying to go up there and help to set up these medical systems, and we think that this film will actually enlighten the world and bring a greater sensitivity to the problems which all of you people are facing in the jungle. But our Indian friends said, yes, but how do we know that you aren't going to go chasing through the jungle just trying to find uncontacted peoples to get dramatic footage for your audience? And we said, well, we can guarantee that's not what we're going to do. And they said, well, we're not sure if we really believe you, because once you get out there, you know, your filmmaking instincts will take over, the thrill of the chase, etc., etc. So finally, we made an agreement with them. We said, look, if we should happen to see the Mashkopiro women, we assure you that we're not going up there to sort of chase through the woods looking for them. But if we should happen to see them, let us photograph them, for goodness sake, because everybody has photographed them. It would be silly if we held off. But we promise that we won't go over and follow up in any kind of way. And they said, all right, if you'll do that, this is okay with us. And when we went up the river, in fact, we took two representatives, one of the local indigenous organization and one of the national one from Lima, and they traveled with us on the trip. And we did, in fact, as you noticed, we did, in fact, meet the Mashkopiro women. And this was a very poignant and very painful moment for me personally, because my first reaction as we saw them was tremendous excitement and emotion. I thought, this is why I got into anthropology. The hope of going beyond the edges of our world, like an astronaut, only I'm traveling laterally instead of out into outer space, going outside of our world, meeting people who really are so different from us that there's hardly any point of contact between their culture and ours, and trying to understand how they look at the world, trying, in fact, to bridge the gap between them and us, and to bring this understanding back to my own people. This was what I thought anthropology was all about when I first got into it. But then my next feeling, I mean, that all went through my mind in a flash, my next feeling was, but there's going to be no meeting. We have given our word that we will not go over so much as talk to these women. Now, thinking about it, of course, what could we have done? I didn't speak their language. They didn't speak mine. If I went over to talk to them, it would have been a sort of a dialogue of the deaf. But it would have been a human gesture. They would have understood that we were friendly, we were trying to make contact. We would have understood that if they had responded. There would have been some human contact. As it was, we kept our promise. We took some pictures. They waved at us. We waved at them. But I felt like a voyeur. I felt like somebody who was treating them as if they were in the zoo. And that was very painful.
My guest is David Mayberry Lewis. He's a professor of anthropology at Harvard, and he's the founder and president of Cultural Survival, an organization devoted to helping tribal societies control their own destinies. And he hosts a new public television series called Millennium. He's also the author of a companion book called Millennium: Tribal Wisdom in the Modern World. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. David Mayberry Lewis is my guest, the host of the new public television series Millennium and the author of a companion book. As part of your work for this Millennium series, you returned to the Xavante of Brazil. This was the first indigenous group that you ever studied as an anthropologist.
Right.
You first went there 30 years ago. And when you went there, this group had a reputation in Brazil for being ferocious. What had earned them that reputation?
Well, it was simply because the frontier, the Xavante, had moved away from the advancing Portuguese frontiers of settlement in the early 19th century. And they'd moved right out into central Brazil, into a sort of a no-man's land, where they were left alone. And then the settlers caught up with them again in the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, and the Xavante fought back. So that in the 40s and early 50s, when small planes used to fly over Xavante villages, they would look down and take photographs of these tall, well-muscled men racing out of their huts and firing arrows into the air at the overflying planes. So the Xavante got this great reputation as being the tough Indians of the interior. But the professor from whom I learned my first lessons in Brazilian anthropology, Professor Herbert Baldus at the University of São Paulo, my wife and I studied with him. And Baldus wrote a very important article in one of the major São Paulo newspapers entitled, "Are the Xavante Bellicose?" Well, as you can imagine, he came to the conclusion that they were not. The Xavante were simply doing what anybody might be expected to do. They were defending themselves. Well, that was fine, and I believed Baldus, and I'm happy to say we discovered that he was quite correct in our later years with the Xavante. But at the time when we were planning to visit them, it wasn't at all clear that they would understand that my wife and I, when we went to visit them, that we were not bellicose. We put down, it was a Brazilian Air Force plane, which flew us to a little airstrip which had been established by an advanced post of the Indian Service, an attraction post, which was trying to persuade the Xavante to come in and make a peaceful contact with the outside world. And there was, in fact, one Xavante village which had established itself fairly close to this attraction post. And there was a little airstrip there. So this Brazilian Air Force plane put down and left the propellers running. It was a little beach craft. Bundled my wife and myself and our small son out onto the airstrip, a little bit hastily, I thought. Threw our bits and pieces and all our expeditionary gear and all the presents that we'd bought for the Xavante out onto the airstrip, and said, we want to get out of here before the Indians arrived, and took off.
And they just left you there.
And that left us in this very, it's the loneliest moment I can remember in my whole life, really. We were standing there, the three of us, two and a half, with our bits and pieces now looking pathetically inadequate around our ankles. And the Shavanti, the young men, of course, since they run fastest, were running into the airstrip. They arrived at the end. We could see them loping towards us, looking like ancient Greek athletes. They had their hair flying out behind them. They were stark naked, well-built. And they raced up to us and gathered around us and immediately started pointing at the carrying sling, which my wife was carrying the baby in, because it was woven by the Shirenti, and it was a type of weave, a palm weave, which they also use and which they recognized. And then with much trepidation, I said my first words to them in Shirenti, and I said something like, you know, can you help us pick up these things and carry them to your village? And to our intense relief, they burst out laughing, because they'd never expected anybody who literally dropped in on them out of the sky to say something, anything intelligible, and they could at least understand me. But I spoke funny. I didn't speak Shavanti, I spoke Shirenti. So they thought this was hilarious. And they gathered up our bits and pieces, and we were taken in with much rejoicing. And later on, I became a kind of a buffoon in their society. You know, the way I spoke was funny, what I did was funny, the questions I asked struck them as intensely amusing.
But that made you non-threatening.
And exactly. And my incompetence was also funny. The fact that I couldn't follow a trail. Because when Shavanti wander off through the forests, they don't set out together. One man just goes off, and then his friend goes off a few minutes later and follows the first man's trail. But I couldn't do that, because I couldn't follow a trail. And the Shavanti found this absolutely incredible. I mean, a grown man who seems to have his wits about him, and he can't follow a trail that is so broad that any Shavanti child could follow it. So they realized that amongst them, I was really like a babe in arms and had to be looked after. And they looked after me, and that was very nice.
So you returned to the Shravanti recently for the Millennium series. Did you let them know that you were coming, and did you ask permission to come with a film crew?
Oh, yes, very definitely. It wasn't the only time I'd been back to the Shravanti since those early days. I had been back to them once or twice before. Then there had been a long period when I didn't go back. And then I started going back to the Shavanti again in the early 80s. And when the Millennium series was being made and we wanted to go back and film among the Shavanti, I made a special trip to the Shavanti, and I got up in the men's circle, as is customary, and asked formal permission of the elders of the village to come with a film crew and make the film.
Did they know what a film crew was, what a film was?
Oh, yes. By this time, a lot of Shavanti have been out in the outside world, and they have experience with film crews. Not everybody. There are Shavanti there who didn't really know what it involved. But there are other Shavanti who are very sophisticated, who've been to the big cities, who've lived in the big cities. And in this particular village, there was much discussion about the film crew coming, whether they should be allowed to come, what we should pay them to be allowed to make the film. And finally, the Shavanti settled on a payment of 150 head of cattle. And the Millennium producers decided that that was reasonable. It was rather expensive, but reasonable. And so we made a deal with them that we would come back the following year, make the film, and deliver 150 head of cattle for the privilege. The only problem with that was that when we came back the next year, our film crew had a fixer, as film crews customarily do, arranging things in Brazil, you know, arranging all the logistics, which are very complicated, of getting this crew from place to place. And it was the fixer's job to arrange to buy 150 head of cattle up in the interior. Now, I suspect that our fixer was more accustomed to taking film crews to Copacabana Beach than he was to buying cattle in the interior. So he made a deal with a local rancher to buy 150 head of cattle, but before we actually got up there, the price of cattle went through the roof. So surprise, surprise, when we get into Shavanti country, the rancher says, oh my goodness, I didn't think you were coming. I've sold all the cattle I was holding for you, and of course I could try and gather another herd together for you, but that'll be a quite different price. I suspect that he just didn't want to sell at the old price. Anyway, so we were stuck. We were up there, we were with the Shavanti, and now we were going to have to pay double what we'd originally estimated for this herd of cattle. And
I could just see you putting this in your end of the year budget analysis.
Well, our poor Michael Grant, one of the producers, was with us, and he went white since he was trying desperately hard to control costs. And you know, controlling costs when you're making films is virtually impossible. So he sort of turned to me and he said, "Well, David, you know, the Shervanti will understand, won't they, that the price has doubled, and so we perhaps can only afford half as many cattle." I said, "Michael, they won't understand at all. Shervanti are not interested in price. Our deal was 150 steers. That's what they'll expect." So Michael swallowed hard, and we bought the 150 head of cattle at twice the original estimated price, and he just had to deal with it in his budget.
I wonder if there's anything that you would most like to have that you don't have, but you found that people in tribal cultures do have. A sense of, some, you know, a sense of family or a sense of connection to the earth or whatever. I don't know what it would be. I'm thinking of
I could put it, sum it up in one word. It's connectedness.
Mm-hmm.
These people have a sense of connectedness, a connectedness to the cosmos, a connectedness to the earth, and a connectedness to each other, which I find beautiful and enviable. Our civilization has prospered by analyzing, breaking things down, taking things to pieces. But somehow we haven't been so good at putting it all together again.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's a great pleasure.
My guest has been David Mayberry Lewis, professor of anthropology at Harvard, founder of Cultural Survival, and host of a new public television series called Millennium, and also the author of the companion book, Millennium, Tribal Wisdom in the Modern World. And the Millennium series begins this evening on most public television stations. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.